Good evening. I am Kilo 2, Romeo, India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. You'll also hear Kilo 2, Kilo Echo Yankee, and his name is Mel. Mel and Dick try to organize this slightly crazy group of guys, very enthusiastic people, who primarily are located in the New York City area, northern New Jersey, southern Connecticut, southern New York, but by way of Echolink and IRLP, people apparently are listening and occasionally signing in from even greater areas. Main purpose of the technical net is to bring these enthusiastic amateurs together to help each other. The majority of the subjects that are discussed on the technical net are those subjects that you bring to the net as a question. And ham radio operators, inside of each one of them is a sort of a scientist from my point of view. So they'd like to know how radio really works. How does this wireless stuff really work? The schools and the books only do a partial job of educating us on that subject. We slowly teach each other how transmission lines and antennas and transmitters and receivers and satellites and propagation and moon bounce and meteor scatter and F2 layer propagation and Faraday rotation and all this kind of jazz. There's a lot to learn about how radio really works. We don't have all the answers at first. Some errors occasionally occur. That's a given. But eventually, by way of this brain power that exists, that comes together for this particular net, we eventually find out what the truth really is. There's an ongoing experiment taking place for the last couple of months in the New York City area, and we give them high priority. Wesley and John at N2XJN and John KC2WGB are investigating rather seriously magnetics. And that's the one great big hole in our knowledge of electronics. The magnet
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Hope we haven't timed out the machine. As I was saying, the magnetics is a great big hole in our knowledge. The schools teach less about magnetics than they do about electronics. And without magnetics, you don't get sound, you don't get motor motion, you don't get electromagnetic radiation. So these two guys are proving how serious they are, because they're putting their money where their mouth is the way we normally put it. In other words, they're buying some pretty expensive machinery and instrumentation to measure magnetic properties. They have many lofty goals in this investigation. And typical of any investigation, all of their goals probably will not be met. That's the normal course of action of an investigation. You don't know what you're going to get. Otherwise, it wouldn't be investigation. If you knew exactly what you're going to get, it's called production. And there are people who will take some of the goals that John and Wesley are seeking and say that this is crazy. They shouldn't be doing that. Well, they have the resources. They're willing to make the dedication. And real science can possibly be taking place, and you can be part of it. You can contribute to the operation and listen in if you want to. Just to give you an example, a guy named Albert Edison tried to create a light bulb, and while he was doing that process that went on for a couple of years, various knowledgeable people said, this is junk science. Here's this crazy man trying to create light using electronics, and everyone knows the only way you get light is with fire. So this guy is trying to create an electronic fire inside of a glass envelope. He can't possibly succeed. Obviously he did. So you got to be careful not to prejudge. Alrighty, a person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
And you got to not do what I do. That is, every minute and a half, you're supposed to give an interruption to reset everything. You give Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes. And the word yes means you do have a question or a comment. The technical net has existed for 28 years and 2 months, and it's already won a national award. As such, by now, after 28 years, we believe people are listening. So we don't have to have a great number of people signing in saying, I'm listening. The majority of the people who sign in are doing so because they do have a question or a comment. As I said, John and Wesley are already signed in. Anyone else who has a question or a comment, for the net tonight. Please give me your call letters and name right now. KQRIW listening.
KC2RFN, yes.
Okay. That mysterious person, thank goodness I know his name is Alan. He's the guy, by the way, who nominated the technical net for this national award. Alan has signed it. Anyone else? Give me your call letters, name, and the word yes at this time.
Good evening. K2KEY.
Another mysterious guy named Mel. Okay. We got Alan and Mel. Anyone else with any questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now.
Good comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Earlier there was a gentleman, I believe, coming in from Puerto Rico, so you may want to give a little break after the beep just for a couple of minutes to see if he wants to sign in.
Yeah, I think that was Whiskey Papa for Kilo Yankee. If he wants to sign in from Puerto Rico, I'll let him do so right now. We'll wait long enough. And maybe he doesn't really have a question or a comment. So one last call. Anyone with a question or a comment tonight for the technical net in the New York City area, no matter where you're coming from, we'll wait long enough for the machine to let you come through. Give me your call letters and name at this time, K2RIW. Okay. Maybe we've got not as many sign-ins tonight. Wesley, I'll let you go first, or you and John decide who's going to go first. I was hearing during the week that a major trip out to Chicago / Wisconsin took place, in which another piece of machinery potentially was going to be bought, and maybe this particular one was not a successful trip, although you guys have already bought quite a few pieces of instrumentation and machinery. In other words, I think a horizontal milling machine, a vertical milling machine, spectrum analyzers, network analyzers, all kinds of jazz you guys have been gathering. So what took place this week and what's next on the agenda? N2XJN and or John, KC2WGV, Wesley first, K2RIW listening.
Dick, you're really not waiting long enough. You should count to 10.
Okay. In other words, count to 10 in between each delay is what I think you're saying.
Count to 10 after the beep starts. Because a lot of times it takes 6 seconds just to free the thing up. So it depends where they are.
Okay, anyone else wanting to sign in? Let's try it one more time. I'm going to wait a full 10 seconds after the beep. Anyone else wants to sign in? No matter where you're located, give me your call letters and name. And the word yes at this time. K2RIW in the TechNet, we're listening for 10 seconds.
This is Whiskey Papa 4 Kilo Yankee. Radio operator Will Burconnelly is located in Puerto Rico. Just checking in for net.
Okay, I did hear Whiskey Papa 4 Kilo Yankee from Puerto Rico. And I think he said he's just checking in. I believe he didn't request to be on the list of someone with a question or a comment at this time. So we're going to give one more listen for 10 seconds beyond the beep. In case it's anyone else, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Any questions, we'll go on as the net goes on. This is Whiskey Papa 4 Kilo Yankee for Puerto Rico.
Very fine. Whiskey Papa 4 Kilo Yankee. We'll try to wait long enough in between the conversations so that you get a chance to add your question or comment if one comes up. Okay, Wesley and or John, we're going to go to Wesley first. What was the latest development this week? K2RIW listening. You got it, Wesley.
N2XGN. Good evening, everybody. I took the trip to the guy that I was trying to purchase the machine from. He was in Wisconsin. And although he was kind of difficult to communicate with, I decided after he approached me with his phone call to go over there. So I took a few $1,000 in cash with me, and I went over there. 20 hours of drive, very little sleep, and I was able to get there around 7 p.m. And then, obviously, I saw the machine. It was a little jewel, horizontal CNC that could serve as a small meeting center. Beautiful stuff if somebody wants to make anything, including CNC, the PCB board. Let me drop. And the guy was kind of disturbed. Later on, when I came back, I asked my wife, who is a psychologist, what could be that. The guy allowed me to see the machine 5 minutes. It was running without a spindle arm, just with the axis on its own program. The machine was made by Gilman for the show, so it's a niche of the big machinery that they make. It was really a little jewel. Then the guy probably in his own mind, I'm not going to judge if it was primitive or not, it was just that the guy thought that if I drove 20 hours, I must be really, really trying to get this machine. And he used the wording, so, you want it or not? I didn't have a time to answer the question, and then again, so you want it, and use any kind of words, being even more excited. And I say, well, how about if we wait till the morning, because right now you don't have a light in that shop, and I see the machine only with a flashlight and the light of your forklift. So he said, this is mine, could be yours, and you've got to decide now. You want to see the machine tomorrow morning, give me $500 in cash, I will wreck it now. I said, excuse me? He said, I will wreck it now. Then he didn't see my answer. He struck the machine with his forklift. Of course, it was mostly posing than action. And he lit the machine, not even, breaking the keyboard, pulling the power cord, so there was no light, but the machine was switched on. Pulled the machine with a full speed out of his place, and he said, you want it or not? Well, a very unusual tactic for convincing the potential buyer to buy the machine. And I went to the car, saying no word, let's go. And then I closed the lock, and he's yelling at me, you said you're going to have the money. So behind the closed windows, I show him, yes, I do have more than enough for that. He said, so you want it or not? I slowly pulled out my car and left. I was afraid that in this condition, he had his 15-year-old son, a very nice person, and a very knowledgeable one, who was able to figure out how to run the machine. I'm risking a lot. He could pull all of the money and say that I never paid, or he could do anything. It was dark behind the buildings, and I was afraid that something made off happened. And then I drove another 20 hours home. Can you believe that? Now, I have also the question about the ferro resonance, but first, Mike, back to you. I'm doing this.
From my point of view, Wesley, you did the right thing. A majority of the time when somebody tries to force a deal in a hurry, saying that you got to take it right now, or somebody else is going to take it, or it's going to disappear, or take it or leave it right now. Whenever somebody forces a deal under such duress, the majority of the time, it's not a good deal. There's a reason why a person is using such tactics. So I think you're correct to walk away from this one. He sounds like either a person using some form of tactic you don't want to get involved in, or a person who's not mentally stable, is what he sounds like. In your circumstances, I would have walked away also. Go ahead with your next question, Wesley. K2RIW on the deck net.
Yes, Hendrix, yeah. Well, he said a few words that let me understand his behavior. He said, I couldn't sell the machine for 1.5 months. And I waited 2 hours trying to figure out how to run this, whatever the words he used, and very bad words. So he was kind of upset. Probably the business didn't go good, and he was really down. Anyhow, in my search for the free energy, I was looking at the frequency, or any frequency that particles of ferrite could resonate, and we already covered in one of the sessions. Let me jump. And the resonance in a T circuit implies a specific frequency determined by values of resistance, capacitance, and inductance. For serious resonance, the condition of the resonance is straightforward and is characterized by minimum impedance of at zero phase. The story is different in parallel resonance. But then, if we go to the power connections, which is the Y delta connection, then we're dealing with the ferro-resonant over-voltages that could occur in power systems. But the certain power system configuration will increase network susceptibility to ferro-resonance. And of course, various number of protection devices being installed to prevent that. A three-phase transformers are connected to the end of, let's say, 100 kilometers transmission line. A three-phase RLC load are connected to the low voltage of this transformer. That's one way of dealing with that. So, my question is, in particular, for me to understand it better, how the ferro resonance of the power line, if it's using word ferro, is explained for others to understand and me as well, and how the ferro resonance differs in the resonance circuit, and one of them I'm dealing with using a ferromagnetic pipe that is contained, constructed from 20-30 of ferrite ring. Back to you, Andrew.
I'm reasonably sure, Wesley, I do not have the answer to your question. I'm going to tell you as much as I know and what experience I ran into with something called ferroresonance, which at the time I didn't thoroughly understand it. But I'll tell you what my encounter was, from which we can maybe make some sense out of it, and hopefully there are other people listening who can give us more information and the benefits of their exposure. Let me let the machine drop. Okay, when it comes to an inductor and a capacitor, with a usual resonating circuit, if I put the inductor and the capacitor in series with each other at the so-called resonant frequency where the inductive reactance and the capacitive reactance equal each other, the inductive reactance has a positive sign, a positive sign with a 90-degree offset. The capacitive reactance has a negative sign with a 90-degree offset. You put the two together, the reactance completely cancels, and only the series resistance that's left in the inductor and a little bit of equivalent series resistance that's left in the capacitor is left. So with a series circuit, as you slowly tune the frequency of a signal generator, and you look for maximum current flow or minimum voltage drop across the LC circuit, and 0 degrees of phase shift, those three phenomena, 0 degrees of phase shift, maximum current, zero or minimum voltage, as you sweep the frequency, tells you where resonance took place. Correspondingly, if I put the inductor and the capacitor in parallel with each other, when you hit resonance, and it's the exact same resonant frequency in theory, now you get maximum impedance. The inductive and the capacitance cancels each other, but because they're in parallel, the circuit begins to act almost like an open circuit. So in parallel resonance, you tune for maximum voltage, minimum current, and again, 0 degrees of phase shift. Let me drop. If I use ferrite materials, inductive materials, any kind of materials, iron-like materials that have a mu greater than unity, mu greater than air, it means that the same number of turns of coil gives me a larger amount of reactance, a larger amount of inductive reactance, a larger amount of henries of inductance. There's various ways of putting it. That's the main reason why you use ferrite materials. You're now able to use a physically smaller inductor or a physically smaller transformer with a smaller number of turns of wire around it in order to achieve the desired desired amount of inductance. Now, I had experience on a 400 cycle three-phase transformer, a very high power transformer that was transmitting something like 5,000 watts of power at 400 cycles on a military circuit. This happened to be the power supply that went into the encoder line replaceable unit, a box that went on the B-1 bomber. That particular power supply took 400 cycle, 240 volt, three-phase power into its primary with an elaborate secondary rectifier and voltage regulator circuit. It was producing a large number of amperes. I forget the number of amperes on 5-volt power in order to run hundreds of integrated circuits that all ran at 5 volts at that time. Let me drop. This supposedly was a well-designed transformer, but occasionally something unusual would take place. I'm not quite sure, was it a spike on one of the three phases? The three-phase 400 cycle power was being locally generated within the factory. A large motor generator set was taking 60 cycle, 440 volt power. That went into the motor. The generator connected to it was generating three-phase, 400 cycle, 240 volts in order to simulate the power supply that was on the airplane. Occasionally, the transformer would go into something that they called ferro-resonance. I'm not quite sure what it is, but when it occurred, the transformer would make a very loud singing sound, and the voltages coming out of it were very disturbed, and the circuit stopped behaving in the normal manner. What initiated this? It was some form of saturation characteristic taking place, I think, in at least one of the phases of the three phases of the transformer. I think it was a Y connection on the primary, but I'm not positive right now. But some form of saturation and or resonance took place, which in our case didn't require 100 kilometers of wiring all the way back to the source of power. It was a couple of 100 feet of wiring back to the generator that was in the same building with us. In fact, that motor generator sat about 100 feet away from the laboratory that contained this piece of electronics that was being tested. And so when it went into this ferro-resonance phenomena, as I said, the transformer would do some kind of partial or circulating saturation of the primary winding. The transformer would sing. It would draw tremendous amounts of current. It would pop circuit breakers, and the thing would shut itself down, and then they would restart it. What was wrong with the design that initiated
repeater, timeout, cancel?
What could have been wrong with the design, what initiated the condition, right now I don't know. And what we did to solve it, again, I don't know. I hope Glenn is available, KC2QIQ. He's the man in the New York area that we've discovered so far that seems to have the greatest amount of experience with magnetic circuits. Maybe Glenn, if he's available, can tell us what his impression of ferro resonance is, and is that what I was experiencing? At least those are the words that were used by the people in that laboratory when it went into this fault condition. So, Glenn, I wonder if you're available. KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet. Okay, we may not have Glenn with us right now, and maybe we're going to have to repeat that question when he does sign in later on. So, as you can tell, I've heard the words, I don't know what it is, Wesley. And as you can tell, I'm not a great deal of help on this one right now. KC2QIQ, and give a delay in case anyone else has some words to contribute. K2RIW on the TechNet. So far, not very much help on this one, Wesley. N2XJN, go right ahead.
N2XJN. Well, the thing that is getting me confused is it being called servo resonant. What the name came from is probably that somebody very much knowledgeable in this area name it because of his knowledge. Is that the contents of the ferrite is somehow affecting that phenomenon? Is that we deal with kind of happening that we're trying to cancel because it's disturbing to us? At the same time, it might be the key to whatever I'm looking for, which is the free energy. We're dealing with the resonance. Is it that particles of the ferrite are resonating somehow or getting into the sensitive to the certain frequency? Which would be strange because everybody is looking at electrical the resonance. Back to you, Andres.
Almost all magnetic materials that have a mu that is greater than air, and the materials we're talking about, the ferrite, powdered iron, and whatever, iron-like materials that have a mu greater than one, which means that the magnetic field will flow through that material considerably better than it does through air. You put a ferrite rod down the center of a solenoid coil, the coil will display a greater amount of inductance for that number of ampere turns, for that number of turns of wire. That's the good news. But almost all magnetic materials have a saturation characteristic. You can increase the current through the coil, whether it be an AC current or a DC current. In either case, you can eventually approach something called saturation, where if you plot vertically the amount of magnetic field that's present in the iron-like material, and horizontally you plot the ampere turns, the horizontal, they call it the B, ampere turns is the letter B for boy, and the magnetic field response, H, is the vertical axis. And when you plot that curve in the beginning with the right setting up of the axes, let me drop. In the beginning, the graph looks like a 45-degree line. For every time you double the ampere turns on the horizontal axis, you get double the magnetic field, the B and H, the H on the vertical axis. It's a 45-degree straight line at first. As you continue to increase the ampere turns on almost any piece of iron-like material, eventually it runs into a magnetic saturation where the curve starts no longer being a 45-degree straight line, but starts curving over to becoming a flat line. It starts becoming horizontal. And if it's an AC circuit, when you start swinging the AC voltage in the opposite direction, on the other half of the sine wave, so to speak, most saturating materials do not retrace the same curve. They come back down with a slightly different curve, and there's an area in between the two. That's called the hysteresis loop. So once materials start behaving in a nonlinear manner, the instantaneous inductance changes in a nonlinear manner, and therefore what you previously called resonance, I could take a parallel or series LC circuit, which contains magnetics, and I slowly increase the amplitude of the resonant signal. In other words, I found the resonant frequency for small signals, and I start increasing the amplitude. Because of this saturation characteristic, you develop a brand new inductance, a brand new number of Henrys for that coil. So I could start off with a coil where I'm using it at a slightly higher frequency where it's not quite resonant, but because I've made the amplitude of the signal loud enough, strong enough, and I'm now approaching saturation and the inductance is decreasing, that means the coil that previously was tuned to a lower frequency is now tuned to a higher frequency.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's now tuned to a higher frequency, and because I'm exciting it from the signal generator at a slightly higher frequency above resonance, I now can get a repetitive kind of super regenerative characteristic. If you ever studied the way a super regenerative receiver works, or the certain kinds of blocking oscillators, you can now, with a simple magnetic circuit, with a constant frequency and constant amplitude coming out of your signal generator, because you're running into a saturation characteristic of the ferrite material, it can now be jumping in and out of saturation, in and out of resonance, and you get a amplitude modulation of the signal across the LC circuit once you start entering this nonlinear region. So therefore, you can have a kind of secondary oscillation of amplitude of the signal created by what you think is a passive network that's going into this nonlinear partial saturation phenomenon. Whether or not that is called ferroresonance, I'm not sure, but I have seen that take place. I've seen it take place on a Yig filter that's used at a low frequency. I've seen it take place on this transformer that I told you, the three-phase 400-cycle transformer. So this could be related. And by the way, there are kinds of constant voltage transformers. Let me drop. There's a kind of transformer you can buy which is intended to give you a very constant 115 volts of power output, even though the voltage going in from Con Ed or Loco might be going between 95 volts and 135 volts. There's a kind of transformer you can buy which uses a partial saturating, resonating characteristic of a transformer with a capacitor across it, which I think is made to resonate close to 60 cycles, and the net result is that the output voltage you get from this transformer doesn't change very much, even though the input voltage does change. It's a kind of an automatic regulator. I've owned one of these things. They're a little bit noisy to use, but they seem to work very well. I'll bet you Mel has owned one of those. I'm going to pass it over to him and see if he's got some words. I wonder if you've ever used one of those constant voltage ferro-resonant type power transformer things. K2KEY, K2RIW in the deck net.
He took the words right out of my mouth. I basically was going to say something about this. I saw this effect on it, and I never understood really what was happening when the effect of this. I described it usually as a lockup, you know, the system locked up or whatever. I found that the only way, you shut it off and start it up again, and as you approach the point of saturation, it did something crazy. You know, it didn't behave normally. It is akin, Dick, to an effect if you took a good old Bridget meter with an inductor and you begin to bring the control, you know, the frequency control towards the point of resonance of the inductor, and you watch the meter and it dips down, and then if you overcouple, you notice all of a sudden the resonant point, the needle jumps up again, and you have to back it down and start all over. Do you know what I'm trying to bring out, Dick? Over.
WB2HWW, would it come in on this subject?
How we recognize? Yes. A grid dip meter, when you try to get maximum accuracy of the frequency of resonance of a circuit, and you're using a grid dip meter, with some training, you'll recognize the fact that you will first hold the grid dip meter coil close to your circuit. You'll sweep the frequency back and forth until the needle dips. Then, because of your experience, you'll start backing away at the greatest distance you can be where you still can resolve the dip. When you get minimum coupling, you'll get the most accuracy of what is the real frequency of resonance when you're using a grid dip meter of your unknown circuit, real frequency of resonance of your unknown circuit. When you study what used to be called an IF transformer, an IF can as they call them, the primary coil and the secondary coil, both are resonating at, say for instance, 455 kilohertz. If you have undercoupling between primary and secondary, you get a very simple Gaussian-shaped curve of amplitude response versus frequency. It's a Gaussian-shaped curve, a single hump, so to speak. As you start bringing the two coils together, primary and secondary, closer and closer, you'll get a flat top performance. Bring them a little bit closer together, you'll get a mu-shaped performance. In other words, you'll rise on the left-hand side of the skirt of performance, you'll hit a peak, then there's a middle bathtub of a valley, then the right-hand peak, and then back down the right-hand side. You get a shape of a curve that looks like the Greek letter U. An overcoupled transformer does that. A grid dip meter that is too tightly coupled to a coil gives you that double humped curve, and therefore, as you sweep the frequency dial, let me drop. As you sweep the frequency dial in the grid dip meter, you'll get this peculiar characteristic when you're seeing those two humps, so to speak, or you see it, it literally hops from one frequency to another. In the case of a grid dip meter, another very complicated phenomenon is taking place. It's called Adler locking. If you've got a free-running LC oscillator circuit, and if you're driving that oscillator, well, let's say your circuit is oscillating at, let me pick a number, 100 megacycles. And if you've got a carefully controlled, amplified signal generator, and you're injecting a small amount of signal at 100 megacycles, you'll make a slight increase in the amplitude of the oscillation. If you bring the signal generator that's injecting a signal a little bit lower than 100 megacycles or a little bit higher, the free-running oscillator will lock into that frequency. This phenomenon is called Adler locking because Mr. Adler studied it. So you're getting an Adler locking phenomenon, you're getting a U-shaped coupling curve characteristic, you're getting a whole bunch of funny things happening when you overcouple a grid dip oscillator, a grid dip meter. And therefore, the greatest frequency accuracy occurs when you make the coupling as light as possible when you back away. Is this approximately what you've experienced, Mel? So turn it back to Mel first before we go over to Howie. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, you can well imagine when this happened when I was quite young, you know, working with grid dip meters really were an essential part of radio work. And I could never understand exactly what is happening. That, like you say, if your coupling was too tight, it was just, all of a sudden you lost your dip. And you start all over and you bring it down in that effect. And if you, like you say, moved away so that now the dip wasn't so pronounced, but just enough to see the dip, that was the most accurate point of the measurement of the resonance frequency of that particular tuned circuit, over.
Once you're getting these kinds of nonlinear phenomena, overcoupling and a double-humped, U-shaped curve of amplitude response versus frequency of an overcoupled circuit, once you combine that with the free-running oscillator that's in the grid dip meter, which has Adler locking characteristics, under certain conditions, you can get what looks like chaotic behavior. In other words, this very simple circuit, as far as a schematic diagram is concerned, can have an amplitude versus time response that looks like it is being modulated by some other circuit, if you know what I mean. The nonlinearity looks somewhat chaotic. If you know what the mathematics of chaos is concerned, it has some of those characteristics. Let's see what Howie wants to answer all this. Go ahead, Howie. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, WB2HW. Three things. What you're discussing is a swinging trope. Collins actually developed that. You take a swinging trope with a capacitor across the trope. As you draw current, less current, more current, it changes resonance. Now, as far as a ferret resonant power supply, they were very common in the 60s and 70s in 12-volt and 24-volt base stations. Motorola and GE used ferret resonant supplies instead of using pass regulators. You had yourself a separate winding, and you had yourself a capacitor across it, and sometimes you had a choke input filter, and it used to have a warning, be careful, it could be 600 volts across the 12 volts, across one of the windings on a 12-volt supply. So they had a separate winding which would inject energy back into the transformer through a capacitor. So, and also, you know, for anyone, you guys know this, when you have an IF cam there, Dick, when you or any kind of a filter, like a cavity or anything, or a duplexer, the more coupling you have, the broader the response is going to be. You want, the sharper the curve you want, you got to have more attenuation, you got to reduce the coupling. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, let me say a couple of things about self-regulating power supplies. Under normal circumstances, if you're not adding the complication of an electronic regulator to your filter, to your rectifier filter power supply setup, many a simple power supply contains either a half-wave or a full-wave rectifier on the secondary of the power transformer. That quite frequently goes into either a choke input or a Pi-type filter network. The Pi-type filter network has got an input capacitor to ground, a series inductor, an output capacitor to ground, and then the output of that network goes to the rest of the circuitry. Under normal circumstances, if the rest of the circuitry draws more current, the voltage coming out of that filter network will decrease. And how much it decreases is a function of the so-called regulation characteristic. If you're smart enough to make the inductor, the series inductor, in such a way that it partially saturates, that under higher current conditions, the amount of inductance decreases. The net result of a less inductance on that high filter network is that you will now get a greater output voltage, is the good news, and a little extra ripple is the bad news. So you can, with proper design, on either a choke input or a high input filter network, when the series inductor is properly designed, and then that kind of a design is called a swinging choke, because it is literally changing in henries of inductance as a function of what current flows through it. And by having just the right shape and size of the air gap inside of the iron core of the choke, you can control the method by which it saturates, and therefore, over a certain current region, let me drop. You could make a power supply that, say, is supposed to supply 300 volts. Under normal circumstances, it starts off at 320 volts. Under full load, it drops down to 280 volts. A real power supply might do that. With the proper design of a swinging choke, which maybe does or doesn't use ferroresonance that sometimes feeds back to the power transformer, there's all kinds of ways of doing this, you can now make a power supply that, with no load, will give you 310 volts, and then the full load gives you 305 volts. In other words, you get a much, much smaller change in voltage versus current when you properly set up these swinging inductors, swinging choke type networks. And some of those could be using this resonance phenomenon with the right kind of a capacitor across the choke. So simple, passive-looking networks with no active electronics involved can be giving you the early equivalent of voltage regulators that were being used in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, before we started using tubes as voltage regulators and pass transistors as voltage regulators, which, by the way, do a much better job. That's why the so-called swinging choke and ferro-resonance transformers. We almost never hear about them anymore. Let me drop.
May I make a comment, please?
KC2, QAQ with Thomas?
Yeah, you're the guy he asked for earlier, Glenn. You hear much less of these swinging choke and ferro-resonance circuits because they tend to be a little bit noisy. They tend to emit rather large magnetic fields. They're a little bit massive. Most of our electronics these days has electronic voltage regulators. Some of them have no transformers at all. They just simply rectify directly the 110 volts coming in, and then electronically with switching regulators and voltage inverters and whatever, they do all of their voltage regulation with much smaller circuits, sometimes more efficiently. So these magnetic techniques, which were a little bit of a black art in the day that it was being practiced, are very unpopular today, and therefore we don't hear these words. Let me let Howie make his comment, because he came before you, Glenn. Then we're going to go over to you to explain this ferro-resonance, and maybe if you heard earlier, this ferro-resonance phenomenon on a three-phase transformer. When we ran into it at AIL, it was very troublesome. Howie, go right ahead with your comment. K2RIW in the deck net.
First of all, ferro-resonance is still being used. If you look at a Master 3 repeater, or even a GE Orion, both General Electric up to recently and Motorola were using ferro-resonance supplies because they're much more reliable. You know, believe it or not, I brought to the technical, I had an Astron supply. I even put much better transistors in, and I was having transistor failures, trying to draw 70, 80 amps continuously. I went to ferro-resonance supply, and I actually picked up a couple supplies and got them on a repeater system. The only thing is they will give you unregulated, no load, will give you about 16 volts. Under full load, maybe 14 and 3 quarters. You got about a 1.25 volt. But most of your electronics has internal regulators in most of this equipment. A lot of the stuff can handle 16 volts, 15 and a half, no problem. The only thing that doesn't use any regulation is the PA stages. The biggest problem with ferro-resonance supply stick in repeater services, you've got to be careful with the audio. You got to run some kind of balance line or run double-shielded audio cables and leave the outer shield open on one end. Try to locate the supply in such a way that it's at a right angle so you don't get coupling. And they also put out heat, but they're reliable. A ferro-resonance supply can last you 20, 30, 40 years. You'll never have a problem. But in a conventional linear supply, you can have failures. As far as switching supplies are concerned, Dick, in repeater service, a lot of people don't want to use them because...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
How much did I time it out, Dick?
Only about 4 seconds. I'm going to let the machine thoroughly reset.
I'm going to make a comment on what I said, Dick, but basically, they don't like using switching supplies because they can generate RF noise on the RF carrier.
Good luck to it. Sounds like it's going to pick up.
Yeah, what Howie is telling us is something that I've also experienced. Any of these power supplies that do voltage regulating by magnetic techniques, which really is partial saturation of the magnetic core, they tend to emit very strong magnetic fields. So any audio circuitry that's nearby can easily pick up that excess magnetic field, and it ends up as hum on your microphone circuit. So you got to be kind of careful with those. And they're becoming a little bit less popular these days because with proper design, electronic voltage regulators made out of transistors and switching regulators can be made fairly quiet, can be made very reliable. The best example I know of is that power supply that existed for 12 volts and 50 amperes that's in QST Magazine, the December issue 1999 and the January issue of 2000, on the nose. That supply invented by a ham radio operator in Chile. When you look at it, it's a lot more elaborate in schematic diagram, but every single extra component in there, he knew why it's there. He did it to increase the reliability because he was designing power supplies. Let me drop. His name was Manfred Mornhenweg, and I've had quite a few conversations with Manfred. XQ2FOD, I think is his call letters, lives in La Salina, Chile. He was building these power supplies to be put on mountaintop repeaters in the country of Chile. Getting to the mountaintop was very difficult. Therefore, he had strong motivation to make a power supply, electronic switching, voltage regulator, inverter-type power supplies. He wanted to make them extremely reliable because for him to go back to that mountaintop to fix a faulty power supply was a big deal. He wanted to build a power supply, install it, and forget about it for the next 5 or 10 years. He succeeded in doing that. And so it's an extremely well-designed power supply which uses no exotic components. The main power supply transformer that's in there, he wound it himself as a guy who really understood mathematics, magnetics, if you know what I mean. Wesley wanted to make a comment before we pass it over to Glenn. Go right ahead, Wesley, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, there are a few things affecting the ferroresonance. One of them is the ground. One of the answers I would like to hear from Dan is what is really ground doing or grounding doing with the in respect to the ferroresonance, and at the limit to damage the distribution system that is sustaining the overvoltages. I know that it's supposed to be 1.1 pu across the transformer windings, and I remember 125, it was 125 pu across the metal oxide lighting arresters. So the lighting arresters are another way of dealing with it. Also another question that I have is, Glenn, if you remember why that thing was named ferroresonance, is it something to do with ferromagnetic material, even though that some of them use the traditional core. Dick, back to you.
As you can tell, Glenn, we're not very familiar with these terms. We don't feel comfortable with them. You seem to be the guy who's got the greatest amount of magnetic engineering experience in the New York City area, so we're certainly going to be tapping into your brain from time to time. What is ferroresonance? This crazy characteristic that I saw on a 400-cycle, three-phase, Y-winding transformer, where it sometimes went into a very loud singing characteristic, which was some kind of a failure. Describe to us what is ferroresonance and some of these saturation characteristics of magnetic circuits. KC2QIQ, the best thing we've got to a magnetic expert in the area, K2RIW. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Much to my surprise, I turn the radio on, and the first thing I hear is all this talk about ferroresonance. I'm like, wow, interesting. Ferroresonance is really not a mysterious thing. I know a lot of people do. It's heavily misunderstood. But in a very, very simple way, it can be your friend, or it can really be your enemy. Earlier on, you heard people talking about the ferroresonant power supply, where you can use the ferroresonance to create a regulated output voltage, which is a very nice thing, people like that. And another thing I didn't hear anybody mention is that the ferroresonance regulated power supply will also give you power factor correction. Isn't that nice? It's kind of a freebie that you get along with it. Let me let it drop for a second. Okay, what is ferroresonance? Okay, ferroresonance in a term is a transformer that's saturated. And usually the transformer that's saturating has some kind of an air gap in it. Basically, the air gap is there so that you have some place to put some of that peak flux into a mu of one instead of just into a heavily overheating material. So you need a lot of iron when you're going to do this. The other thing that you need is to complete that circuit is you're going to need a tank circuit. You need a capacitor and an inductor. And basically what's going to happen is that when a transformer goes into saturation, the first thing you'll notice is the waveform of the current will start to square off on the top. Or it might peak up and go very, very high, depending on the mode in which it's in. When you put the tank in parallel with it, that actually helps to limit the current so that you don't wind up with like the short circuit phenomena where the input circuit breaker will pop. Let me let it drop for a second, and then I'll mention the difference between the regulator of voltage and the bad phenomena that you know in the three-phase power transformers. Am I covering it so far, Dick?
You're doing very well, Glenn. Please continue. And add an extra couple of seconds after the beep just to make sure everything reset for people who are far away listening. You got it, Glenn.
Okay, so far so good. Now the thing is that there's a, you know, ferroresonance is it's a very, very loosely used term, but in a three-phase power transformer, what can happen is that you basically have three primaries and three secondaries. You can either wire them in series, parallel combinations, whatever. There's a very nasty phenomenon that can happen where if one of the phases goes unloaded, in other words, normally those kinds of transformers like equal loading. You know, they can tolerate a certain amount of imbalance in phases, but a real nasty thing that can happen is if you have a ganged circuit breaker, one open or a device fails, where basically you have two loaded windings and one goes open. What will happen in that particular case is because of the leakage duct of the transformer, and you might also have some capacitance on the primer, that when that one winding goes unloaded, what can happen is it can create a resonance on the primary circuit, where currents will continue to flow in it, along the same DC period as the AC input generator. So let's drop. That could be a very, very bad condition, because if you have current flowing in the primary that's still coupled to the secondary, and it continues to flow at no load, you could wind up with an extreme overvoltage on the secondary winding, and some of it be reflected back on the primary winding. And it'll lock up into that oscillation, and that's a nasty thing. You'll hear horrible sounds, humming, and if you have any electronic circuits nearby that are being affected by that overvoltage, boy, they can get wiped out real fast. I'm not sure if that's the... let me stop after this one and just see if that was what you had experienced. That is a very nasty failure mechanism of ferroresonance in a three-phase power transformer.
Everything you've described so far, Glenn, is exactly what we experienced on this three-phase, 400 cycle, 240-volt Y-delta transformer. I'm pretty sure it was a Y-primary transformer. Could have been a delta, but I think it was a Y. It's what we experienced on this 5,000-watt power supply, 5-volt power supply, rectifier voltage regulator on the main encoder line replaceable unit on the B-1 bomber. This is way back in 1985, 1987 or so, we experienced this. It's an extremely destructive-like characteristic. Thank goodness in our case, the circuit breaker would open because it would sense the extreme primary current on at least one of the phases, and all three phases would then become open. So what, in your opinion, other than unloading, because it was a six-phase or three-phase full-wave rectifier on the primary, and it wasn't any failure of those rectifying diodes. So because it was a three-phase rectifier coming off the three windings on the secondary, going into six separate diodes, and then into a filter network, the idea of unloading one of the phases probably was not taking place in our case. There was a kind of a motor generator set that was 100 feet away on campus at AIL in Deer Park that was powering all of this. And I think that thing was capable of, you know, 40 kilowatts or something like that. We're only drawing 5 kilowatts for this particular circuit. I wonder if you could make a guess as to what initiated the failure. And what do you believe is the corrective action to avoid the condition? It only happened once every month or so, but when it happened, it scared the daylights out of everybody, and I'm not sure they really knew what to do to correct it.
Is that 400 cycles, Dick?
That's what I've been saying, 400 cycles. So if you were there, Glenn, what would you have done to correct it? Wait for a couple of seconds. And Glenn, give us a little bit more audio.
Turn it off.
Speak a little bit louder into the microphone. Over to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
How does that stick? Is that a little bit better audio?
Just right. Please continue.
Okay. Opening one line is